Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have with us today Justice Gina Benavides from the 13th Court of Appeals. Welcome, Judge.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you.
Thanks for being here with us. In case you don't know Justice Benavides, she sits on the 13th Court of Appeals, which has chambers in both Corpus Christi and Edinburgh. And we'll talk about that court a fair amount during this conversation, I believe. She was first elected to that court in 2006 and took office January of 2007 and has been there ever since. Did I get that right, Judge?
You did. That's exactly right. 14 years.
Oh, that's great. Well, tell us about your background and what led to you becoming a lawyer in your life before becoming a judge.
So I'm born in Laredo, raised in Corpus, and started practicing in the Rio Grande Valley. So I'm a first generation Mexican American. My mom is from Mazatlan and my dad was from Laredo, Texas. So I consider myself a border rat and love it and never strayed too far from the border. Went to school here in Corpus and then went to UT undergrad where I have a degree in business in petroleum land management because I wanted to be an oil and gas lawyer. And then somehow ended up becoming an appellate justice on the 13th Court of Appeals. So one of the things I tell when I speak to students that whatever lawyer they thought they were going to be is not definitely the lawyer they end up being at the end of their career. So I don't know, to be perfectly honest, how I stumbled across the idea of becoming a lawyer, other than my mother tells the story that when I was in about fourth grade, I came home and told her that me and my main name is Martinez, that me and my best friend, who's Teresa Martinez, was going to have the Martinez and Martinez law firm. And I'm happy to say that both Teresa and I did become lawyers. She's a lawyer up in the DC area. We never practiced together, but I early on became very enamored with the law and the changes that it could bring. And I was one of those lucky few that just kind of went right through. So after UT, I applied to law school and went to University of Houston and got out in 88 and been practicing ever since.
Go Cougars. I've got my red shirt on today.
Yes.
We've had a number of Cougar lawyers on the show. That's quite interesting. So petroleum land management?
Yes. I wanted to do the oil and gas law. I loved contract. I loved real estate. Really enjoyed that aspect. Of course, if anybody recalls back in 85, which is when I graduated from UT, that's when oil and gas prices bottomed out, was one of their bottom outs. But then I went to law school, and then somewhere along second year of law school, I went, maybe not. And then, so I started looking around, did a stint at the district attorney's office there in Houston, was very active in legal aid at the University of Houston Legal Aid Clinic and actually helped run it my third year of law school. But that's also hard, as anybody who's ever done pro bono and legal aid. My heart is still there and I do a lot of legal aid. I did a lot as a lawyer and I do a lot as a judge. But then I just started looking around and started interviewing with different firms. I knew that I wanted to go back to small town, did not really want to stay in the big town of Houston or go to Dallas. Or I was recently married and wanted to start a family and wanted that small town, and was lucky to be interviewed with the law firm of Adams and Graham, which is one of the oldest defense insurance litigation firms in the Rio Grande Valley. Great bunch of guys interviewed me, offered me a job, and I was there for the next 12 years and did all sorts of insurance litigation for 12 years. So that was quite fun.
Adams and Graham, are they in Harlingen or are they in?
They are in Harlingen but practice all through the Rio Grande Valley. And actually, you know, we all started back in the day. I started cutting my teeth on workers' comp, just like everybody of that term did, and represented great companies like HEB and every type of slip and fall that could hurt at an, could happen at an HEB. We represented L&F Distributors. We represented Whataburger. So we had a thriving practice. And you got to remember back in 88, when I joined the Rio Grande Valley, if you looked around and tried to find a female Hispanic lawyer doing litigation work, we were hard to find. So I was one of the few women working at Adams and Graham, and definitely the first Hispanic female working at Adams and Graham. And so I tell people I was lucky, because then it put me in the forefront of a lot of that litigation with Adams and Graham. And towards the end, I was doing all their toxic tort litigation, asbestos litigation, silicone implant litigation, and that was statewide. And that started sending me to litigate cases in El Paso, San Antonio, Austin. I kept trying to tell my clients that San Antonio and El Paso and Austin weren't quite as close to Harlingen as they thought it was. They all just thought, tried to explain to them it's two planes to get to El Paso, Texas. But spent many a time doing a lot of that toxic tort litigation, enjoyed it. So it became more of a statewide practice at that time for Adams and Graham.
You mentioned being the first female Hispanic litigator, or one of the only ones around. I suspect that may have been true of you also in your undergrad course with the petroleum land management.
It was very much so. In most of my, especially the crossover engineering type of classes that we had to take, definitely one of the few females and definitely one of the few Hispanics. I'm pretty used to being the only female running around in most boardrooms and most organizations. I tell the story, it's a little bit of a different story, but I tell a story that after I left Adams and Graham, I switched sides and joined up Jaime Gonzalez, who I went to undergrad and I met at UT as an undergrad in the 80s, and asked me to join him. He says he was tired of me beating him up in courtrooms. So since he couldn't beat me, he decided to hire me. And so I switched sides. So depending on whether you're a plaintiff or defense lawyer, I either saw the light or went to the dark side. So for 12 years, I was corporate, defending corporate America, and then I went to sue corporate America for the next 7.5 years. But I remember being in Zapata, Texas, which is, you know, down on the border, in a big products liability, rollover, roof crush, seatbelt case. And there was 15 lawyers in that courtroom defending different parties. And I was the only female in that courtroom. And that is not unusual. And so I definitely used it to my advantage, because jurors didn't like mean men picking on the only female in the courtroom. So I really did use it to my advantage. It was quite, assisted me a lot in my career to get ahead. I use it as a tool to get ahead, as opposed to using it as a detriment.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge. What made you decide to leave practice and run for the bench?
So when I joined Jaime's and we did a lot of product liability cases and commercial liability type of cases. It's a very boutique. It was just him and me and staff of three. And I think that all of us will ring true is that the trial practice changed a lot at that time. A lot more mandamuses, a lot more interlocutory appeals. And even if you got a verdict, everything was appealed. And so we definitely, because we were doing a lot of those discovery fights for documents and such, we ended up finding ourselves quite a bit, both at the 13th and at the 4th court. I had done some with Adams and Graham, but basically, you know, we had a board certified who's Roger Hughes, who everybody knows at Adams and Graham, to handle most of the appeals, even though I assisted him. But at Jaime Gonzalez and me, it was just him and in. We would hire lawyers to assist us with the research because as the litigators, you know, having those downtime to sit down and do the hard research was difficult. So we would have appellate lawyers help us do that, but I did all the arguing. So with Jaime's office, I argued at the 4th, at the 13th, and at the Eastland Court of Appeals. And I just started getting really frustrated that I felt like I was having to retry my cases at the appellate level. It was very, very frustrating. And I thought that they didn't give credence to what these trial judges were doing. And so I looked around and said, someone needs to do something and change this. And it was the right time. The right opportunity presented itself. And so I decided to run for the 13th Court of Appeals. And I would have never done, I would have been ever gone from being a litigator to an appellate judge. Just never.
I think a lot of people don't realize this, but I was looking at a map. You know, the 13th really stretches geographically from just right outside of Houston all the way down to the border.
Yes.
How was it running an election in that huge area?
So you can't travel from one end of our county to the other without stopping somewhere to sleep. So when I describe it to people, I say we're from the very tip of Texas. And if you go up 59, we go all the way to Buc-ee's because everybody knows where Buc-ee's is on 59 before you get to Houston. And if you go up 37, like you head to San Antonio, we go all the way to Three Rivers, which is where 281 joins 37. And everybody knows that loves point there. So it's a law and it's a very diverse jurisdiction. But it worked for me, Jody, because that was the area I practiced law. I tried cases in Nueces County. I started as a lawyer in Cameron County and I had been in Hidalgo. So to me it was a very easy, it seems big to you, but to me that was my playground. You know, that's where I was born and raised and was a practicing lawyer. So it was no big deal for me to go to Beeville or Victoria. I knew people. I, you know, tried cases in those jurisdictions. So that was a big area, but I liked it.
It seems pretty common among lawyers down in that part of the state to travel around a fair amount and go to different counties.
Yes, it was not unusual with an asbestos litigation to be pretty much 3 days a week doing depositions in Nueces County and or traveling to either or for experts' testimonies or parties or whomever. We all had clients everywhere. So you just kind of go where the work takes you. Lots of miles on your car, though.
I bet.
So you made the decision to run.
Yes.
So tell us about that first election. You were not given the privilege, as many of our appellate judicial guests were, of being first appointed to your bench. Is that right?
I was not. I was also not a trial judge before I ran. So I was an appellate and I took on an incumbent. So I kind of took everything that they normally tell you don't run in against an incumbent. I took on an incumbent in my own party, a Democrat sitting on the bench and a female. So pretty much what you normally tell people not to do, you know, I just didn't listen, said, no, this is the right time for me. This is the right place. And believe that I could do a better job than that and put forward my platform and just went straight in. As every election is for any candidate that you will ask, it was an eye-opener. Not my first election, though, Todd. I ran for school board in Harlingen and lost. So
School of Hard Knocks politically.
Oh, there's nothing like a school board election to teach you the rough spots of an election. That is deep and dirty, school board elections.
But you've been, since then, after that first election, you've been reelected to your seat twice.
Correct.
2012 and 2018. As of right now, you've got 2 or 4 years left on your term.
That's correct. And I'll contest it. So unfortunately, I can never say that I've run unopposed. I've always had opposition in all my elections.
You've done it the hard way.
I have.
Nothing tells me this is a pattern.
I know. Yeah, I never seem to find the easy way to get things done sometimes. So
we talked before we got started recording about the 13th court a little bit. You know, you're the rare court that actually has two different courthouses. So did you start down in Edinburgh once you took the bench?
I did. You know, the Corpus Christi Court started in Corpus Christi when it was first created in the 60s. It was a spinoff from the San Antonio Court of Appeals. And then in the 80s, it slowly developed the Edinburgh office. It first started with the clerk. And then as judges got elected, they got offices. And I'll put that in air quotes because Melchor Chavez, Linda Yanez talk about how there were more closets down at the courthouse than there were offices. But as population increases and population shifts, then we've got the full court in 93. And then, of course, when we actually started hearing cases in Hidalgo County with our own courtroom. So we've always had and now, of course, we officially changed the name. So it's called the Corpus Christi Edinburgh. We have three major counties, Cameron, Hidalgo, and Nueces County. When the court was first, Nueces County was the highest populated county in our 20-county jurisdiction. It is now Hidalgo County, followed by Cameron, and then Nueces, it runs in third. So you can see where the populations change. So we love having two counties. It makes our work a little bit different. I wouldn't say harder, just different than those who all sit in one county. But we make it work. It just has its different bumps in the road that we have to overcome.
I'll go so far as to say that the 13th Court, or the Corpus Christi Edinburgh Court, as people need to be reminded, is the official name.
Yes.
Was groundbreaking, if you look back on it now, because of having those two different sets of courtrooms and chambers, because you all, even before this terrible pandemic and all the other things that have been happening to us in the last 6 months, even before that took place, you all kind of got in the habit of working remotely, working cooperatively between two different cities. And
we always have.
You had a boost in technology that allowed you to do that.
Yeah. Since I joined the court 14 years ago, teleworking has always been how the court has worked. When I joined the court, the chief, Roy Valdez, sat in Edinburgh, but the clerk of the court, Kathy, and then Dorian after that, sat in Corpus along with a senior staff attorney. So we had conferences by video conferencing since the beginning. And if we wanted to talk to each other, either email, telephonically, or by what we used to do by then, by Skype, or our internal video conferencing, not unusual. Both courts have always been connected by video conferencing. So if we ever needed to have a complete court, getting all six of us either in Edinburgh or Corpus was sometimes difficult. We tried to do it on OA dates, but we couldn't. And we always had the ability to video conferencing OA arguments, whether it be, we always offered the option. If you're, for example, a Corpus lawyer and you're ended up with an appeal that sits out of Edinburgh and it was going to be OA, you could go to the Corpus courthouse. You didn't have to drive the 132 miles from Corpus and sit in the Corpus courthouse. And we could set you up by video conferencing to argue your case. And all of us, at least at one time in our careers, I don't think, including myself, have attended oral argument by OA. If it's one case out of a docket of five or six, was it really worth me that day to run down, to Corpus to hear one OA case for whatever reason? No, then I just sat. And so we've always done that. So when the pandemic came into place, we just kind of kept operating the way we've all operated, because many of the judges had staff, our attorneys are in different locations. So we just kept doing what we'd all been doing it. We just were all working from home. That's the big difference, as opposed to working remotely in our chambers, we're all working from home remotely. That's the difference.
Has your court had Zoom oral arguments, Judge?
Yes, we were actually the first one to have our Zoom arguments, and we did so in May. We were the first appellate court to do it. So we had full docket in May by Zoom.
So that was really not that big of an adjustment for you all, because you'd already been connected by video link anyway.
Yes, and all of us being able to do this, once you're used to doing this argument by video and knowing that, you've got to watch the little nuances and making sure you allow the person to finish speaking or it's a little different in a video as it is in live, but once we got used to that, it was not a problem at all for any of us. So I think it was harder for our lawyers. They like to be in front of us. But for us, it was not that big of a deal. We continue to have weekly judicial meetings, just as if we were in chambers. All of us are just at home and not, you know, before there would be a couple of us in the office, you know, in the office. Now we're just all sitting, usually at our kitchen tables is usually where we're sitting, doing our conferences and doing our Zoom. And we already set September. It will be by Zoom. And notices will go out next week for October as Zoom as well. Hidalgo County's numbers are still too hot. And it's still one of the hot spots in the state of Texas. And as you know, Todd, we don't want to make lawyers travel to Hidalgo County because we do have a lot of out-of-town lawyers that come argue in our court. And but there's no necessity to bring them down to Hidalgo County to argue when it's still considered a hot spot. That doesn't make any sense. So we're not. So probably through the year, Hidalgo County issued an order this week, no jury trials to December. Corpus Christi, Nueces County is through October, no jury trials. So we'll play it by ear and see what November and December holds forth.
How are the cases assigned between the two courthouses for argument?
Actually, they're assigned by panel A and panel B. Oh, you mean assignment, like how do you know you argued in Corpus versus Edinburgh?
Or? Right.
So Edinburgh hears all cases from Hidalgo, Cameron, and Willacy, and Kennedy, little town, Sarita, Texas.
Right.
There occasionally we get an appeal out of there. And then every other case is heard in Nueces County. And that's the way the statute actually reads when they created the two courts. So anything Kingsville, Corpus Christi, the Wharton, and Victoria and Beeville are heard in Nueces County.
The 13th Court of Appeals, I'm very familiar with your court. I believe Jody is too. And we're not just casual observers of any of the 14 intermediate courts. But we talked off the record about sort of what I think is an antiquated perception of the 13th Court. And I'll just say it, for some reason on this show, I tend to be the one that asks the hard question. But there over some time in the past has been a perception that the 13th Court was very plaintiff friendly and much more so than a number of other of our intermediate courts. What would you say to that, Judge?
Well, I'll just be, it's a lie. It's just false. You know, I heard that too, when I was practicing, and I wish that was true. As a plaintiff's lawyer, I could have won every case at the 13th Court, and I didn't. So, but definitely when I joined the court, we always looked at the numbers, and never have we ever been. I think there was 1 year early on when I joined the court that we were like at the top three. But other than that, we are not the most reversed court by the Texas Supreme Court or the Court of Criminal Appeals. And as we look at the numbers, that's just not so. It's just, you know, people get this perception. They say early on in my career, I'm very close to Judge Hilda Tagley, who was a county court of law district judge in the course and finished her career. She's a senior justice federal judge out of the Southern District. And I had a big case in her courtroom and we were speaking afterwards. And she said to me, you know, Gina, facts are malleable, but perception is rock solid. It's harder to change perception. Facts can be changed easily. And she's right, because that whole perception, even though we argue about it and continue, and it's an issue at every campaign, including the campaign 2 years ago that says they bring integrity to the court because we're the most reverse court. It's not true. But to try to change that perception, and it's been 14 years, is hard. Because that's the perception of the 13th Court. And if you look at our numbers, that definitely, we track them very closely now. It's not even close. As a matter of fact, the Supreme Court now takes less cases from our court. Just to begin with, our PIT of reviews are down from the 13th Court than any other court. So they don't even take more cases from our court than they do. And as a matter of fact, in recent years, they're taking less cases from our court. Probably because I write such great opinions and and they're going to leave Gina alone. I wish that was true. But they definitely, it's a perception that we fight about every 14 days. And it's just not true. It's not.
And I know we've had Kent Rudder on here and we've talked about Pam Barron a lot. And, you know, to your point, both of their statistical studies of courts of appeals dockets and Supreme Court dockets back that up. You know, the things that are public show that as well.
Yeah. And if you look at some of the cases that you look where we are reversed, And if you really are appellate nerds, as we all are, and probably all that listen to this, it's usually making new law when we get reversed. It's usually a new standard of review, a nuance, or a new statute looking at it. You know, you can look at Menchaca, the new insurance case. That came out of the 13th court. We got reversed, but that created new insurance law. So, and as we all know, we can't make new law. We have to follow the old law. And that was reversed and remanded because they realized they made new law. And in the interest of justice, they needed to retry it because it wasn't fair to the litigant in that case. I wish they recognized that a lot more, because it's really hard for these litigators to try a case thinking the law is one way. And then when they get all the way to the Supreme Court, they find out the law gets changed on them. And they were paid by a different set of rules. And that just drives me completely nuts.
Amen to that. Absolutely.
So I tell people that I used to watch OA arguments at the Texas Supreme Court, but I literally was about half the time I was screaming at my computer screen, of course, yelling at them like, that's not what the opinion said. Or definitely not what my opinion says. And the other half, I just wanted to throw my laptop, that I just actually stopped watching Texas Supreme Court OAs. Unless I could if I could just, you know, do one of those Zooms where you can shoot questions, you know, while they're in OA from the audience. Can I have my own questions? And so, you know, that's the nature of the game. I mean, that's their prerogative. They're at a different set. It's really hard when you're campaigning to get that message across, even to lawyers, that they're under a different standard of review than we are. You know, we are bound by precedent. We're bound, you know, to give full discretion to our trial courts. It's an abuse of discretion. And we can't just go and up make new law and say, there's a lot of time I think the trial judges are wrong in their ruling, but I got to give them the benefit of the doubt. That's what the law says. So it is what it is.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly. And Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today. One example that Kent talked about when he was on the show is summary judgments.
Yes.
The statistics when it came to looking at the 13th court versus some of what we would consider to be the conservative courts were really sort of reversed from where you thought they might be. Like the 13th court reversed plenty of summary judgments.
Plenty of summary judgments. We do.
That's, as we all know, that's de novo standard of review. And so the trial judge has to get it right. And the 13th court has a complete re-review of that ruling. So we're not offering any deference to the trial judge in that situation.
And then remember, you know, where our jurisdiction and geographic is. You know, we have 20 counties, and even if you consider Hidalgo County, the biggest of our counties, it's sitting at about 900,000 population in Hidalgo County. Our area is still considered rural. Our judges are still all general jurisdiction judges, which means their docket is full of criminal, civil, family law, and a whole other assortments every morning that they need to hear, as opposed to Houston, which their civil cases are coming out of civil-only judges. So I have great respect for my trial judges who are dealing with all sorts of cases all day long, and it's just them. Just one judge out in Warren County. It's only, you know, we still have traveling judges out of Brazoria and Warren and Victoria and Beeville and all the little counties, Jackson, DeWitt. I mean, some of those have more cows than they do people in those counties. You know, it comes to us in a different view than I think in others. And so, and they're just trying to move their docket down in Beeville and Victoria, and they don't have even the resources that we do and some of the resources that our trial judges do have in bigger cities.
You know, you've talked to several times about running for election. I know that you've been particularly outspoken among judges about kind of the discussions that have gone on the last year or two about judicial selection. What are your thoughts on some of the different proposals that have come about judicial selection in Texas?
I don't like any of them. Flat out. I haven't shown me one that doesn't solve the problem that they believe they have. And I'm not even sure there's a problem. No one's convinced me that there's a problem to begin with. And so are we solving an imaginary problem? And even if we are to say there is a problem, none of the plans that they show me solve any of those problems. If it's qualifications, there is nothing to say that we don't have one of the best qualified judiciary in the state of Texas. Are there bad apples? Sure. There's a bad apple no matter what. I think there'll be bad apples no matter what process you go through. And none of what they have showed me takes care of that. Is there a money issue? There's going to be a money issue anyway, in any way, form, or fashion. But I do know the thing that why I have been such a strong proponent of elections is because I know that it directly affects the diversity of the judiciary. It is unmistakable statistically that elections favor a diverse over selection. There are books written about it and articles and all sorts of forums that have done it. And we just can go back. We currently have the more diverse judiciary in the state of Texas than we ever have. And so talking about perception, I said, and now that we have the most diverse, when we elected 18 African Americans in Houston, that we have the first, many first Hispanics, Gisela Triana, the first Hispanic on the Third Court of Appeals, my chief, the first female Hispanic of the 13th Court, and you see those issues, somehow now we have to change it. So the perception is, okay, those unrepresentative women and minorities that are now becoming seats of power, somehow now we have to change it. So the perception is you're directly attacking women and minorities by trying to change the system now. I'm on record on all this. I'm not telling y'all anything I haven't specifically told the Judicial Selection Commission, of which I already testified to. And I think that everybody should go listen to those committees because it's really quite eye-opening. I was a final name for the Fifth Circuit under the Obama administration. And no one could ever tell me that 18 months that I went through to get to the final wasn't that at the end of the day, I wasn't the most qualified. ABA, FBI, local bar, big bar. I mean, everybody and their godmother. And at the end of the day, even though I was qualified, and many others before me, Hispanics and females before and after me, who did not get the appointment. That's not to say that ultimately whoever was appointed wasn't also qualified. But the end of the day, you have a Fifth Circuit who represents Texas, has not a single Hispanic on the Fifth Circuit as we sit right now. And that to me just astounds me. In the state of Texas. And it's never had a female Hispanic. That's what the selection process gives you. And so I'm a big proponent of elections. I also think that this election committee is a little premature now because now we've got this not straight line voting and we're not even sure what that's going to do to judiciary elections, especially in big cities. The nonpartisan that some people say, well, you got to be nonpartisan. Why are judges partisan? Well, then y'all figure out how we're supposed to do elections in a nonpartisan. If you have an open seat and you got 9 people that then run for that seat in a general election, how are people going to figure that out? If there's an open seat, I'm just going to put my name in them. It's like city council, right? When there's an open seat at large, you got 10 people running. We've got a mayor city council position open here in Corpus Christi. We've got 12 people and another 9 people from running for mayor. So exactly how does that help supposedly because the voters don't know who they are. They're going to know who those voters are when there's 9 people on the ballot.
You have runoffs in every race, and you won't have the benefit of party primaries to thin out the ranks.
To hopefully, yes, run out the ranks. And so you live and die by elections. And I've lost 2 elections and won 3. So I know how it hurts to lose an election. But this job is mine until I get unelected. And I have to respect that voters. And I respect the voters. I think that when people get unelected, they get unelected for a reason. So.
Well, that's a different perspective than some that we've heard. Most of what we hear that's critical of the current system is you've got to get the money out of it because of the perception about money indirectly somehow contributing to the result in decision-making.
Again, a perception. Where does that perception come in? Yeah, I would love to be able to not have to raise money. It's the hardest part. And actually, the Women Legal Voters think that there should be public funding for judiciary and think that it should come from, y'all ready for this? Taxing attorneys. Since y'all are the ones that are mostly affected by judicial races. And so that's one of the plans that floats around and gets discussed quite often. So, but you know, it is in the Texas Constitution. And it got there, if you look at it historically, because of all the corruption in selection of judges. And so we got where we are because Texas was dealing with a very corrupt selection of judges. And I told someone, if I could select the people that were going to select the judges, I would be okay with that plan. Because I know who I would select is not people who... You got to take it out of the legislatures. I'm sorry. You got to take it away from the governor. And that ain't going to happen. That's just not going to happen. You know, no different than this committee that was set up. The Committee of Judicial Selection, they are good friends of mine. I care. There's not a single sitting judge sitting on that commission. And there are all lawyers. There's not a single layperson on there. Because I think if you ask people, do you want to be able to vote for your judges? They're going to say yeah. They're going to say yeah. So you haven't convinced me there's a problem. And even if I give you the benefit of the doubt that there is a problem, you haven't given me a plan that fixes that problem, whatever problem you think you have in your head. So it's going to be interesting to see.
You brought up your nomination to the Fifth Circuit, which is, we've seen that many times in recent years with lawyers from around our part of the Fifth Circuit. And I was curious about, you know, I followed that, of course, as you were going through that process, but it's not something that, you know, there's sort of any insider knowledge of that's just generally floated around in the legal community. It's sort of a cloak and dagger kind of thing. And
very cloak and dagger. They kept telling me they say you need this and they say you need that. And at some point, I said, someone needs to tell me who they is, because I was never able to figure out who they was. It's just some kind of floating people out there. So quite interesting. So very cloak and dagger, very non-transparent. And ultimate, the decision was made politically and politically only. I know what they told me and what they were told on the record, that I didn't have enough federal experience. Is what I was told, even though I tried cases in federal court and actually have a published Fifth Circuit opinion, but I did not have enough federal experience was there. But I know it was political, and it was political through and through. And so, and it was made in a back room of which I had no control. And so I pissed off someone in the political world in the past as a lawyer. And, you know, 20 years later, it came back to bite me.
Well, and actually, I think that that whole experience is sort of consistent with your concerns about judicial selection in Texas. I mean, I assume would be that would be the nature of the selection process, is it would be just inherently political and backroom deals and that sort of thing.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I attended some of, you know, those people that they're trying to sit you. They have their backroom meetings, too. So you got to go to the backroom meetings of the people that are trying to get you to help. To get you, you know, out of the other backroom meetings. It was an awful experience, to be perfectly honest. And so, and then poof, it's gone. And that's it. And then you move on.
Well, and you don't have to run another re-election campaign for at least a few more years. So.
Yes, I have 4 years under my belt.
I'm happy for you about that, for certain.
Definitely.
I'm one of the weird people, though, that like campaigning.
That's good, though.
I love campaigning. There are some great people in our state of Texas. When I ran for Texas Supreme Court in 2014, I had more fun It was long and hard, and I drove my car to the bitter end. We were carrying the title with it because we knew it was going to leave us somewhere on the highway, and we're just going to have to drive it into a dealership at some point. But let me tell you, I wouldn't have traded that experience and going out and meeting people and talking to people. And not only lawyers, but, you know, the VFW halls, the Women in League voter meetings, all the different newspaper meetings that you have and local people that are really interested in our election process. And they care and they take the time and they listen to you. And it was a lot of fun. I'd rather do that than go through that federal crap that I had to go through for 18 months.
Jody, I'm not sure that Justice Benavidez qualifies as an appellate nerd.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think that's very type A, you know.
I know. Extroverted. It's a little too extroverted for us appellate lawyers.
Right? I know.
That's great, though.
But I really am an appellate nerd.
Oh, I don't.
Just an extrovert appellate nerd. I'm one of those rare birds.
That's right.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're a rare bird. That is.
You are, and that's wonderful. I think it's better for all of us to have people like you on the bench bringing that perspective.
Yeah, a rare bird at best. So,
you know, one of the things that you talked about a minute ago was diversity in the judiciary. You know, another thing that I think has been the topic of recent discussion is diversity in the appellate bar and ways that we can improve that. Do you have some thoughts on ways that we can really be intentional about increasing diversity in appellate practice?
Yeah, as you may or may not know, I've chaired the Appellate Diversity Committee for the appellate section the last 3 years. And what we have tried is to go to reach out to those areas geographically, because that's where you're going to try to grab those attorneys that don't have to be appellate lawyers. But occasionally, we talked at the very beginning of this, trial practice has changed so much that you really do need to have some appellate backing, whether it's yours or someone else, to tell you from the minute you file that lawsuit, whether you've hit all the things you need to get right. Because if you don't plead it right, those motions to dismiss are coming really a lot. Now they're a lot. The interlocutories, all these hurdles we now have to overcome before we get any way down the line. And so those lawyers out there that are doing that need to know that, because they're going to be hit with that motion to dismiss and know why they're being hit and what's wrong with their pleadings to begin with. So we're trying to reach out to those areas and try to say, look, you don't have to have an appellate practice, but you should know these things because they're going to help you in your trial practice. And if you do need help, there's a whole here section that can help you, and we provide great work and assistance to do it. And so I think that the appellate section is doing a great job in trying to reach out. But it's hard. You know, those guys and girls are just trying to make a living and beating the bush. And they're worried about today more so than they are about tomorrow. Really, they're more worried about yesterday, what they did yesterday, than they are about today. And so it's really hard to get them to stop and take a break and go, take a look at this for 5 seconds. Y'all are still practicing law, but don't you remember back in the day when your docket was so full? I mean, I think back of some of the things I did back 30 plus years ago and think, how did I not commit malpractice 30 years ago with not having an appellate lawyer standing right next to me?
Yeah, that's what we keep trying to tell people. You always should have an appellate lawyer there holding your hand, and we're happy to help in any way we can.
I know that Roger saved my butt on more than one occasion, and it's hard. You got to have that person standing next to you to help you out. But we definitely need to do a better job. The state bar needs to do a better job overall. You know, it's been hit with a diversity problem as well, from the top being sued for various things. And, you know, they got them for a minority director's positions and stuff. So we have to do a better job of trying to face what everybody thinks the bar is and what the appellate section is and tell them that's not who we are. So we're working on it. I'm glad to, just as Noel from the Dallas Court of Appeals is going to join me this year. And I'm looking forward. She's bringing some great new ideas, which I'm really happy about. So great, Justice.
I think with the state bar, really, when it comes to directors, I mean, there's close to 40 elected positions statewide. among state bar directors. And so where it really starts, I've always preached in, with bar involvement, that really everything starts locally.
Right.
And so you've got to have folks step up and run, you know, minority candidates or otherwise. For any group that's saying, well, we don't have a say, you know, isn't that where it starts? Is you've got to,
that's where it stays.
You've got to rise up locally.
Yeah. And everybody who complains to me, I said, well, what have you done? Have you looked at this? Have you contributed this? You just can't sit there and say, it doesn't do anything for me without you saying, well, what do you need? You know, and then get involved. Cause I think that once they do that, but we can always do better. Can't we?
Absolutely. And in fairness too, you mentioned the issue of minority directors. You know, the bar's efforts sometimes to try to increase diversity are met with resistance, not from within the bar itself, but from within other state bar members who decide that they're going to bring suit to try to prevent the appointment of someone based on their heritage.
That's exactly right.
It's the bar, I'll speak as a director. I mean, the bar is not a perfect entity, but you know, it really doesn't help when efforts at diversity and increasing diversity are met with that kind of response to hinder the appointment of someone who's going to bring that perspective into the state bar board.
That's exactly right. And that's the problem we've had for years and can't seem to overcome. To a certain extent, Todd, I unfortunately think that it's gotten worse. And it's really disheartening sometimes. I feel like we had come a long way, and then recently I feel like we've all taken several steps back, and it's really disheartening.
Well, we're at some kind of a crossroads right now. I don't know which way it's going to go, and I don't really know what the outcome is going to be. But unfortunately, everyone's very sensitive, having been pent up for 6 months, I think lashing out in ways that maybe they otherwise wouldn't. But there's a lot going on. And so we'll just have to stand by. I mean, this month, there's going to be some things happening in the state bar with some upcoming meetings. And so it's hard to argue, I think, against inclusion.
I know, right?
I would not want to be the person arguing against inclusion.
Inclusion and equity in particular.
That's right.
It really is hard to think. When people do, you're just like, they're missing something, and I'm just not sure that we can teach them that, unfortunately.
Well, we are getting near the time that we have allotted to visit with you, Judge, but we'd love to hear some things from you about some perspectives you bring on, say, advocacy in your court or some of your, we often ask about a war story or a tip. We'd love to give you some time to talk about some things that are important to you in those areas.
Well, I think that what's important, what I try to do at the court is really try to respect the law. I tell this quite often that we tend to get lost in that these are just cases and we're going through them, and try to not forget that we're laying precedent, real people. It's a family law, or whether it's even a commercial case, these are people actually in companies. I represented them for 12 years. They're all truly people. And so I try really hard to, we try very hard on the 13th, and we fight quite a lot at the 13th. I mean, we may all sign off at the end, but let me tell you, there was a lot of fighting going on before, or a lot of discussion going on before it gets signed off by everybody. And I am known as the dissenter on my court. I only did 2 this past year. I feel like somehow let down the 13th court. And so I think that we try really, really hard to get that full opinion out and try to make it a little bit easier for the practitioners to understand it and get it out. I'm trying to think of a good war story. I think that all of the good ones I can't tell, Todd. I'm sorry. I just can't tell any of those. I could get in trouble.
Well, when we're able to get together in person again, and we're in a group where we're at a CLE and we're at the bar, maybe, I will provoke you into telling me one or more of those war stories. As long as I'm not the subject.
I don't think so. I don't think that you and Jody are the subject. Maybe not the subject, but we have seen, it seems like lately the briefs from you guys are getting a little more bitter and nappy at each other. Is it because y'all have been so cooped up in your kitchen tables having to write briefs and can't get out to do this?
That's possible. That's entirely possible.
I actually have been talking to some other folks about that very issue, that, you know, lately there seems to be a lot more banning about of the word sanctions.
And yes.
It just didn't happen before.
Yeah, I've had a couple of, they're complex litigation cases and they're a little bitey. Now, you do know that filings are way down.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sure.
Way, way down. We just got the numbers and they are substantially low. And I'm just not sure how the wave is going to occur now, because I know that they are unfortunately judges who are not doing anything about their docket. There are some that are working, but there are some who are not. And there are some DAs that are moving cases and some DAs that are not. Remember, 50% of our docket is criminal and 50% is civil. You know, it varies, but it's pretty much a 50-50. And we may see this for a while, but at some point, I'm very fearful when this dam breaks, what's going to happen all across the state. When we go back to live hearings, people have these massive dockets. What's also very interesting is that we are down to almost no mandamuses at the 13th court. We actually went 3 weeks, which no one can ever remember in the history of the court, without a single mandamus being filed. 3 or 4 weeks, if I remember correctly. And we have the lowest mandamuses filings that we've ever had at the 13th court. And so I just don't know what's going to happen with that. And what's going to happen to our dockets and what's going to happen in the next 6 months or year. Because I tell people, lawsuits are still being filed. When we were having that discussion, right? Lawsuits are still being filed. We've had 2 hurricanes in the state of Texas. I already got, you know that brings litigation. I've had texts from friends asking me for lawyer referrals because they're fighting with their insurance companies, you know, and I'm like, I don't give referrals. Just for the record, I don't give lawyer referrals. I find that gets me into trouble, especially as a judge. And so I'm not sure what's going to happen when this dam of the pandemic breaks and we go forward. But Justice Newell was telling me they're actually not sending any OA cases in March because they're just not going to have enough cases to set for OA in March.
Wow.
And that's the Dallas Court of Appeals.
It's amazing.
I know. But they're somewhere, right?
Sure.
Somewhere along there, lawsuits are still being filed.
They're all in the trial courts, all backed up. And like you said, kind of like a dam with a crack in it. There's a few that seep out, but eventually it's just the flood is going to come.
And that scares me.
Understandably.
Yeah. The only cases that we've seen on mandamus in the recent months are family law matters because they're desperate. And so, you know, we've never lived through this, through a shutdown of this sort in the court system. With no jury trials for, let's assume we go through December, 9 months of no jury trials. It's going to be real interesting to see. But court filings are down. I mean, even the clerks say their court filings are down. So I'm not sure what's going to happen.
Well, stay tuned.
That's right.
Because we'll be talking about it, I'm sure.
Well, and we're all getting our budgets cut.
It's just going to make it even harder when the wave eventually does hit.
Yeah, because as we know, the judiciary's funding, which is less than, 0.1% of the state, but all that funding really goes to, it's manpower. We're a manpower corporation, right? Company. It's our lawyers and our clerks, and we don't have them. That's the only way we can cut.
Are y'all having to make any staff reductions? I mean, the budget, the year's already turned over, so I guess you know what you're due.
Not right now, but we are expected, and definitely for our next biennium. They've already told us they're cutting us for our next biennium. So we have no place to cut. I mean, the Court of Appeals is housed luckily at the county clerks in the counties that we sit in, so we don't have that overhead expense. So our expense is our people. It's those who sit down and do the research and get your motions filed and get the clerk's records done properly and assist us in getting out the opinions. And so we're going to be hurting, guys, because you're right. When that dam hits, I'm not sure what we're going to be doing.
Right. It trickles down to all of us who practice, too, because yeah. We're going to be hit by the same problems.
Yeah. So it's going to hurt. We need to redo this podcast a year from now and see if we can answer any of these questions.
That's right. We will put it on the calendar, have our part two.
Yes.
Listen, we really appreciate you giving us your time today. This has been really interesting and we've touched on a lot of great subjects, but we'll go ahead and kind of wrap up and let you go on with your day. Before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. And thank you very much, Justice Benavidez, for being with us.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having.
Oh, our pleasure.
Our pleasure.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email at hosts@techsapplawpod.com. Message us on Twitter or Instagram at TechSapLawPod, or reach out through the podcast's Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're all staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at TechSapLawPod.com or on Twitter @TechSapLawPod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.